This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
I'm Tawny Fan. I am the Assistant Superintendent of Business Services for Garden Grove Unified School District here in Orange County, the 14th largest district in the state of California.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Thank you so much for coming on today. We met recently at La Quinta High School at their Lunar New Year celebration that Kim O Dao puts on every year. And it was such a wonderful event. And it was such an honor to meet you. And thank you for coming on today.
Great. Thank you for having me, Kenneth. Yes, it was very nice meeting you there as well. It was a great event.
You know, I have been on my journey to look for a superintendent or somebody who is close enough in that position to talk about the education system and how it pertains to Vietnamese students for many years. I've been looking for somebody to talk about it because I'm closely related to that world. And so why it's important for the Vietnamese community. So if we can start off by talking about your journey in the education system here in Southern California, you know, how did you grow up? Where did you grow up? And what made you decide to get into education?
So I grew up here in Orange County. Our family came to the Westminster area in 1980. So I was four at the time. So you can imagine we're kind of like the first wave of the Vietnamese community being in this local area. And so prior to that, we were actually living in Northern California in the San Jose area, which is another very heavy Vietnamese predominant area that has built up over time. But yeah, so I grew up here in Orange County, went to school in the Westminster Garden Grove area, graduated here as well in the county. So I feel like I just am part of the community in the sense of just watching it change over the years and being Vietnamese and seeing the community grow from a teeny tiny community to what it is now. As far as just me getting into education and what kind of inspired me to get into education, I'd say I had a third grade teacher who I absolutely loved. And I remember writing a paper, I think at some point in our school days, our teachers always asked, well, what do you want to do when you grow up one day? And I remember writing a paper about wanting to be a teacher and, you know, 8 years old, 9 years old, that's what I was thinking. But the reality is, you know, when you grow up in a Vietnamese family, sometimes there's expectations to like go down the road of like, be a doctor, be a pharmacist, be a dentist, be an attorney. And it was funny because my mom joked a lot when I was young, like, you're destined to be an attorney because you're a chatterbox. Like, you have the gift of gab, basically. So I kind of thought maybe that's what I should be doing. And so to be honest, I actually took the pre-med route. I was a bio major and thinking, okay, maybe I'll explore medicine. And when I got to UCLA as a bio major, I kind of decided at that point, like, I just don't think that that's for me. And I had a friend at the time who was a really good friend, and she was working on her teaching credential. And I was pretty close to graduating from UCLA at that point. And I had switched my major so that I wasn't bio anymore. But anyway, so because I had a friend who was interested in teaching, and I kind of saw what the steps she was taking, and I thought back to the 8-year-old, 9-year-old me saying, I want to be a teacher. That's just kind of in the next step was as I started observing her in her classroom, getting a feel for it's different being a student, right? Like you watch your teacher teach, but it's different when you're leading the class and the behind the scenes. So that's really what kind of got me into education was is, you know, sometimes it's that idea like, you know, people and it kind of gets that idea. It plants the seed. It helps kind of help you to investigate a little bit more and explore. So I really have her to thank because that was an area that she was going to the path she was going to take. And I was like, let me explore this a little bit more. And here I am today.
And so you became a teacher. Before we even got into the whole teaching, because you had mentioned that you're chatterbox law, but then you switched over to bio. I mean, what? Because you were on the law track in our conversation, and then you said you studied bio.
No. So I was always interested in science going through high school. I loved all my science classes. And again, kind of like, again, the pressure, I'm sure a lot of kids growing up in the community that are Vietnamese feel that pressure from the family to do certain things, right? Like there's certain careers we do. If you want to make a good living, if you want to do well in life, these are the careers. And so since I liked science, I thought, oh, I'm going to just be a bio major. So what happened was, is I actually switched my major at UCLA over to anthropology. And I know that sounds crazy, but I actually graduated with a degree in anthropology with an emphasis on history. Which is so not, where I'm kind of actively working, but it actually played out really well because it tied in perfectly with the fact that I took a lot of science classes, the fact that I had to take a lot of math along with those sciences for biology, and I also switched over to anthropology with a emphasis on history. I will tell you, that's what got me my first job in the district was there was a very unique opening that the school district needed, and they needed a history science teacher. And I had the credentials in the units, college units, to actually fill that spot. So it's kind of interesting how things work out where you make certain decisions and the opportunity opens up, and you're like, oh, okay. I know I took a windy path, but it actually led me somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, tell me about it. I was an anthro major too, with an emphasis in film. Yeah, and so I value this training, quote unquote, because this is what I do today, is ethnographic work, talking to people in the Vietnamese community throughout the world, and it helps with that kind of background and that kind of understanding of how these historical kind of pieces are put together.
Correct. And I would say with anthropology, even though I had an interest in the physical side, right, which is, you think about, okay, the bones of this and that, right? But it was the cultural anthropology that I was most interested in. And it's one of those things where you don't really know exists until you take that very first class and you're like, this is really intriguing things. And so you're right. It for me now, it's like the observation of people, communities, traditions,
Yeah.
oral stories, how religion started, things like that. Like, I'm very intrigued by that because it's the cultural piece that has developed over time. And you think about like all the different places people have developed their communities, but there's so many similarities as humans, like the way our brain works and what our soul needs to feel fulfilled. It's like, it's just very interesting to see like the convergence of all those things.
I was enthusiastic and really happy to come into conversation with you before, but now it's even more thrilling to sit and talk to somebody with the same shared experience in academics that you and I have, because the work that we do is really a reflection of all these like random things that have happened in our history in the Vietnamese world, the diaspora, that has come together, that really, this is why we're here today, because all these things have happened in our society.
Yeah, agreed.
Yep. So, you go on, you teach history in high school. Is that right?
My first teaching position was actually at a junior high. I taught 7th and 8th grade, so I had a mix of history and science. And then it was kind of interesting because I will say I started teaching in 2000. I just graduated from UCLA. I didn't even get my teaching credential yet because that time period around like 1998, 99, 2000, 2001, there was a teacher shortage. And so if you were interested in teaching and you turned in an application, it was a high probability that you would be hired because there was a teacher shortage at that time. And so I got hired right away, right out of UCLA, and I was working full time while getting my teaching credential. But I will tell you something that I really loved about my first teaching experience or my first year at the school is at that time, I would think that there were only a few Vietnamese teachers in the community. They existed, but there weren't a lot.
Yeah.
And many of them were older than me. And so you have to think, I was born here in the United States. So I'm the true first generation to graduate from high school, graduate from college, and start a career within that timeline of kind of, hitting the professional world in, let's say, between the 1996 2000 range, right? For those of us who are like born in the 70s. So, I remember a student who was Vietnamese in my class said to me, "You are the first Vietnamese teacher I have ever had." And at that point, she was already in eighth grade. And so, when I heard that, I never really thought of it as I was getting into teaching with any goal of like representation in the community. I was just like, I need to start my career and I got a job and I got assigned to this school and this assignment. And so I was going into it just initially more on that side. And then as students were kind of tapping into that thought of like, I've never seen a teacher who looks like me before, and it brought joy to them, I really started to see the impact of just my role as a teacher. And then on top of it, when I started meeting their parents, that opened up a whole nother world of appreciation, because then the parents felt like they could communicate with me in Vietnamese and truly express whatever concerns or even gratitude that they had for the school or the school system. And so that was like really early on in my career that I saw the difference, so that just being representative for some of our students and our demographics was a huge deal for them.
As I've spent more time at La Quinta, I've spent the most time at La Quinta because of Chris Tranburton over there and Kimo Dao are friends of mine, good friends of mine now. I see that I think it's 86% Vietnamese or some high number like that, right? But I also think about the Mexican, the white, the black students that are in that environment. And I think about not reverse discrimination is a heavy word, but the reverse is also true. I think about the future of those kids who are non-Vietnamese and how they might look back in 20 years and go, that was a weird experience. Do you ever think about their experience, the othered who are in that environment that are not? Because you see these celebrations like the Lunar Tet New Year that Kimo puts on, and you're just like, whoa. You see all these other non-Vietnamese that are wearing áo dài, and they're so deeply entrenched in Vietnamese tradition. Do you ever think now about their journey?
Absolutely. And I will say, at the last Lunar New Year celebration, I did notice that it was a mix of students who were participating in the celebration, which I absolutely love. So one thing that's really wonderful about the district that I work for is we cover a huge square miles. We're over 28 square miles in Orange County. We serve seven different cities, and so it's super, super diverse, right? So it's got all these pockets. And so the first teaching assignment that I had, where I mentioned a student said, "You're the first Vietnamese teacher," that school is like the flip of La Quinta. That school is opposite, where it was mostly Hispanic students, right? And very few Vietnamese students. And so the elementary schools that those students went to before they fed into that junior high was basically the opposite experience of what students at La Quinta are experiencing, right? So, just depending on where you're at in the district, the demographics are quite different. So it's interesting because, yeah, so when you're at schools near the Little Saigon area, which I've been the principal at two schools in that area. I was a teacher at an elementary school in Little Saigon, right in the heart, right off of Brookhurst and Westminster. So you can imagine the percentage of Vietnamese students there.
Right
I
across
was
the
the
street
principal.
from the Target.
Yes, not that one, but close. It's in the
Okay.
neighborhood behind
Yeah,
it. It's
yeah.
on the Carl's Jr. side, if you know
Yeah,
that
yeah.
corner. But then I was the principal at McGarvin, which then feeds into La Quinta. So the demographics over there is predominantly Vietnamese. So what I will say is as I visit now in my role, I go to district events all around, and I see a mix of students that are involved in all sorts of cultural celebrations. So, when I see Vietnamese students who are participating in a mariachi band over at Rancho High School, it's the same as seeing Hispanic students do the dragon dance or the lion dance over at La Quinta. And so I actually love it because I feel like we're celebrating and learning about each other's cultures, right? Respecting traditions. And that's what this whole idea of like this community and really helping kids better be integrated into their community because it is a mix. And so as long as it's inclusive and we, you know, it's never like, oh, VSA is only for Vietnamese students, but it's open to all who want to support, learn, and be an ally to all of the different cultures that we have out there. Like, it's so embraced, and I absolutely love it when I go around and visit different events.
Do you ever get parents from these other cultures speaking up about the overwhelming presence of the Vietnamese student body?
No, in fact, I think that what I have learned is they're inspired by it because they see, you know, at one point we were the minority at a lot of these
Yeah.
schools. Like I shared with you in my bio, like if I'm the first Vietnamese student in that class at that elementary school as part of that first wave of Vietnamese students, you know, we were the minority at some point, right?
Yeah.
And so for other communities who are now the minority in our general area, see how over time your community can grow and make a difference and really help kids within the community still celebrate the culture and their background. I think that it's very inspiring for them. And I've actually asked parents, like, do you want to do a celebration? I don't know about your cultures or your traditions. Help me. Do you want to help me set something up for the students? It may not be 100 students strong, but even if it's 15 to 20, let's do it, right? So that idea of like having like an international celebration, whether it's a collective day for all backgrounds, right? Or it's we do it in isolation depending on that time of year because there's a specific holiday. So I actually think it's inspiring for other communities to see like, you know, what we've been able to do in Little Saigon and other, you know, I think about like big pockets of where we have a lot of Vietnamese folks, like again, San Jose, you know, you talk about like Dallas or Houston area, that we were all minorities at some point in the community.
My partner girlfriend is a principal at an elementary school. So I am very close to sort of this education world now. And I want to know, she comes home really beat up and battered every day, energetically wise and spiritually. It's just so draining. It just seems. Can you talk a little bit about why this work is so damn hard?
It is. It's a challenging position. I will say, I was the principal at an intermediate and at the high school. Actually, La Quinta. I'm not sure if Chris or Kimo is sure. I was the previous principal at La Quinta
I
for
did not know that.
yeah. That's why I'm invited back every year. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, so it is. It's a very challenging job for many, many reasons. Number one, I think we all get into education with like that moral imperative that we're hoping to make a difference, right? Whether for students or for parents. For me, it's a combination of a lot of things, but I will tell you, there's a lot on a principal's plate. You're talking about student achievement, right? You're talking about the mental health and well-being of students and staff. You're talking about school safety, right? There's so many things that we have to think about is we're like, okay, how's the instruction going on in the classroom? We got to make sure that we're helping all students achieve. So what happens when students don't achieve? So your brain's thinking about all of the sort of closing the gap intervention strategy. So you've got the academic side of it, right? Then you have students who are challenging in the sense of like with behaviors. Maybe there's something going on and they're exhibiting behaviors and you're trying to figure that out to help them because until their behaviors are, you know, under control or in a place where they can start regulating and managing, they're not going to get the academic. So now you have a student that gap is getting bigger for them, right? And then you have this overarching kind of like school safety. You know, it's hard when you turn on the news on a daily basis and every few weeks or few months you hear of like the tragic something happening at a school. And
Yeah.
so You're thinking about, okay, what's our plan? Things like, so there's so much going on in a school principal's mind, not to mention now if they have new teachers, they're having to coach and mentor these young teachers, right? So there's, and then you have other dynamics. You might have certain parents who are wanting the school to maybe, do things a certain way or to start some initiative or to stop something that so there's the politics of that as well. So it's one of the most challenging jobs to balance because you really have the student stakeholder group, right? You have the parents and then you have your staff. And so it's just trying to make sure that between those three things, you can kind of triangulate everyone's needs, and make sure that all three of those groups, their needs are met. So it is, it's taxing.
So I can imagine being a teacher for a few years and then slowly or being asked or opportunity opens up to become a principal. But
Yeah.
what happens between, because I can imagine it being a very different job description between being a teacher and then being a principal. Where does that transition happen and how does the transition happen?
I would say everybody's journey to being an administrator could look slightly different. A lot of times people think it's like a teacher before principal, but oftentimes there's folks that aren't teachers and can become a principal. So let's say, for example, they could be a school counselor. They might be a school psychologist. So there are folks that are in the field that have other education background that can move into administration. So the journey could be slightly different. But the typical path, if you are a teacher, is oftentimes there's like this middle ground where you might be a teacher on special assignment. So you leave the classroom environment, but you're working on like special projects and you're kind of in this space where you are still supporting classroom instruction, but you kind of learn more of like the logistics of coordinating large events like professional development or induction programs where you're helping new teachers in this role as a teacher on special assignment. So it's a broad sort of job description for those that are on the teacher on special assignment role. But the nice thing is in that role, you're one step removed from the classroom while still supporting the classroom, but you're also working with a lot of administrators on planning and implementation and seeing projects through. And so that's a lot of what, as principals, we do, right? We have a lot of implementation that we have to do. We have to have a timeline, benchmarks, a game plan for how to check back and evaluate and analyze. And so that's kind of like a training ground. And so a lot of folks who have moved into administration will have a couple years as a teacher on special assignment.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat. And then do you sort of, while you're a teacher, do you sort of like get this idea planted in your mind going, I want to move into administration. I need to pick up this time in admin or this time working with special teams in the school to advance my career.
Yeah, I think that people definitely see the role in this sort of teacher on special assignment or special projects as an opportunity to test out whether they want to leave the classroom permanently. For folks, I've seen some people move into that role and decide this isn't for me. I like being in the classroom. I want to be with the kids. This is where the rubber meets the road, because that's kind of where they get their joy. For others, like for me, I'm like a planner. Like I love planning things. I love logistics. I love the kids as well, but I'm very big picture, right? So there are certain skill sets that, you're able to tap into in the admin world or doing like special projects versus being in the trenches daily in the classroom, right? I say the trenches like it's a tough fighting a war or something, but it's not. But when you're with the students and that's really where the magic happens, but it's just a different type of work. So it kind of depends on, I'd say, people's strengths or interests or skill sets and what they want to tap into in terms of going into admin work.
So you're on this sort of special teams and you're doing sort of the work outside of the classroom as well as the classroom. And then at what point does it become an invitation into becoming like an AP or an assistant principal to get to that next step?
I love that you use the word invitation. Sometimes you are invited to consider, like, hey, have you thought of, this next role? And that's great when you have folks that are encouraging and maybe seeing potential in you. And then others, it's sort of like they just feel they're ready for the next challenge. And so they may not necessarily have anyone who taps on them and says, hey, are you interested in doing this one day? But it's self-driven, right? It's self-motivated. And I'd say I was one that I was self-motivated myself, because as soon as I finished my teaching credential, I got my master's right away. I just kept going. And then I got my administrative credential. So I finished my teaching credential, admin credential, and master's within the first 4 years of like teaching full time and just knocking it
Wow.
out, right? So I finished
Wow.
UCLA and I just got it done. And so I knew at some point that I would maybe move into admin, but I just figured let's just have it as like an option, right? Let's just have the credentials ready to go. And so at some point you just kind of like, oh, okay, I'm ready for the next challenge. I'm interested in a change. And so for those of us who are just kind of like self-motivated to kind of grow and push, there's groups that are just, like, okay, I want the challenge. And so that's how you kind of move to the next level as well. But I think it takes a lot of folks encouraging as well and coaching to get a lot of our really good administrators out of the classroom because they don't want to leave. They love the
Yeah.
kids, which we love, but we also see their skill set and the impact that they could have in a like broader scope if they were in an administrative role.
Yeah, I see the mentorship that happens at the level of where my girlfriend is. She has a mentor and she has all of these other senior people that give her, encouragement, plan of action and how to navigate the politics and all the intricacies. I can't believe what goes on in all of that world of education. I'm like, that's why I was so excited to talk to you about this stuff today because it's not as simple as, you go from this point to this point to this point. There's a lot that happens in the background. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you notice, one of the things I had mentioned in my bio to you was is that idea of coaching and mentorship.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I'm very, very passionate about is that I felt coming up through the system, I had a lot of folks that mentored and coached me and would reach out and be very encouraging. But just folks that you could call when there was just kind of like, hey, I need advice on this or walk me through this. And so, because I felt like I had that as well, and it really helped me get to this point, like me giving back in the sense of like for our younger up and coming leaders, or I mean, maybe they're not even younger, they're just fellow colleagues of mine, but just everyone who is in this work, it is challenging and we need each other and we need to have a support system. So that we could do this work.
And so you go on becoming a principal for a few years, and how do you make the transition over to the next level?
So after the next level beyond a principalship would be working at a district office, basically. So you're going to go to central administration. And so at any district office, there's a variety of positions available. Most of it, the title is directors in most districts. And then as directors, it's very specific. Like it's now, instead of doing a ton of different things like you do as a principal, you have directors that are overseeing very specific topics. So I'll give you an example. Like in our district, we have a director that oversees evaluation and research. That's all of the testing, that's all of the data. So it's very specific work now, right? We have a director that oversees instructional technology. So it's all of the technology that's out there that can enhance education. And then those folks are looking for the best products out there, training the teacher. So it gets very specific. And so it's almost like as a principal, you may have like a niche or an area that you are really passionate about and you want to explore a little bit more. And so, if you're like, okay, I now would like to move beyond the site level, and I'd like to go into more of like a central admin role, then they would have to look for something of interest. Director of personnel, director of curriculum and instruction. There's a whole host of things. I moved from school principal to a role called director of K-12 ed services. It's a fancy title, but really what it means is it's really taking grant funding or specialized categorical funding that has a specific objective for student programs, and you're just ensuring that those funds turn into programs with a specific objective in mind. And so I was able to do that for 2 years before moving now to my current role.
Wow. And I think in that role of what you just described, it gives you a good sense of how funds are allocated and materializes into instruction, right?
Yes, correct.
And how do you make sure that you hit the mark when there's so many moving pieces underneath and you can't guarantee what your instructors or your teachers are doing, and you're kind of having to figure out, okay, the money needs to translate into numbers, right?
Yeah, so it's all coherence, right? So in a district this size, I mentioned we have over 38,000 students, over 5,000 employees. It's very challenging when things have to funnel from the top down, right? And so we get the money and you're supposed to do something with it. So the idea really is everything has to channel down to students. And what's the end goal that we're hoping? What is sort of like the metric that we're going to look for? Or what type of services are we going to provide? And really, it's about coherence. And one thing that I find is so important is communication at all levels. Like we have to be very clear and we have to have that communication at all levels so that everyone knows what's our role at each level so that we could execute the plan. Because oftentimes, when there is specific funding that comes, we have a plan for the money. We just don't just say, okay, well, let's just spend it willy-nilly because we know there's a specific objective. So a plan is usually put in place and it's a collective effort to put together a plan oftentimes. And so it's then from there, it's all about communication. So hopefully everybody in the system knows their role for executing and ultimately getting to, what were we are trying to accomplish. So I'll give you an example. If we get funds to increase the number of students that can be in an after-school like childcare program, the goal is we want to serve an additional X amount of students, right? So with this money, maybe we can add another 2,000 students to the program. So we're able to track that and take a look at enrollment rates, participation rates, things like that. And so it's a service to the family, and it's something that if we didn't provide, our families would be either sending their kids home to an empty home, like I was a latchkey kid in the 80s, right? Just walking home. Or they would have to pay for childcare. And so things like that, where we have these extra funds, ultimately it's to support the families. And really, when the students are in these after school programs, it's enrichment. They have fun. There's like things to do, there's homework help, there's sports, there's activities, versus, I was the kid that walked home and watched Gilligan's Island at 3:30. So I know I'm dating myself, but that's the reality.
But you didn't turn out too bad. So you're in this director position for a while, and what starts to kind of go, I'm ready for the next thing?
So this next thing, the director, so in our district, you go director and the next level up is assistant superintendent. And so in our district, we have six assistant superintendents. Now, the structure of centralized admin is a little different in every district. Like some use terms like deputy or chief or, things like that. So in ours, it just basically it goes director level and then straight up to assistant superintendent. And then from there, we have one superintendent. And so in this case, we had someone who was about to retire, and it was just an opportunity and a challenge where it was like, okay, let me take all the years of everything I've done so far and, hopefully apply it to this position. And it's kind of interesting because the current position that I'm in is actually completely outside of the area of work that I did for 20 some years leading up to this position. So for 23 years, being a teacher on special assignment, working as a school administrator, I was on what's called the program side of the house, where we just focus on student programs, right? Now I'm on the other side of the house where it's not programs. I'm all about services. And so the list that I gave you of all the services that we handle, such as transportation services, food services, informational technology, maintenance and operations, like we do all of the sort of behind the scenes, the background stuff to keep things up and running for the school system. So it's definitely a challenge because it's an area that I am taking experience from having been the recipient and the receiver of those services, and now being part of the team that's providing those services. And so I guess for me, it was an opportunity. Again, a lot of just kind of encouragement is like, hey, you might be able to do this well. Have you thought about this? We think you can do it, kind of thing, So there's just encouragement. And so thinking about it, going, okay, well, let's see. If I don't get it, I don't get it. No big deal. I will tell you, when I got into education and I got my admin credential, my goal was school principal. Like, I was like, yay, I did it. I accomplished my mark. I was in my happy zone. That was one of my favorite jobs, even though it's challenging, as you can attest to, probably from the stories that you're hearing at the end of the day. But it really was a very fulfilling job, but at the same time, very challenging. And so for me, I got the position. I was like, yay. I felt like I peaked, like I'm good. So to move to director and then to move to this role, this is all beyond anything that I was really pushing for my own self. But at the end of the day, when you feel like the work that you do can help, like, the ripple effect of each thing that you do, it helps a greater number of people, then it really gives you a sense of like, okay, I'll put in the work. I want to do it, because at the end of the day, it's really about the kids. It's really about what can we do to improve the system for the kids. And so, when you're a school principal, let's say you have 500 to 700 students. Right, when you're a director, like how many students now do you impact in the district? And then now in my role, our services, it's for all 38,000 students. So
This episode is brought to you by Songkai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkai gin. Songkai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam. That's huge. Now, I don't know if you know, if we are tracking the number historically of superintendents that were Vietnamese throughout the history of education in the United States. I am always intrigued by that because being a superintendent of a district is such a massive position, and the likelihood of a Vietnamese person becoming a superintendent in the United States is such a just a slim chance that you ever get to that. Now, do you know of any other superintendents in the history of the United States that were Vietnamese at all?
I can't say that I'm familiar with any tracking as well for that sort of historical data. I think when we met, we kind of touched base a little bit about, I think there might be
One.
one in LA County currently or recently. But other than that, I mean, there was one that was named many, many years ago here in Orange County, and that turned into a huge controversy. I don't know if you know the history on that.
No. Can you
Oh,
talk
yeah.
about that?
So we had a local district that the board actually named a Vietnamese superintendent, and then somehow they decided a couple days later, I believe, I don't know the whole story, and they changed their mind. They changed their decision. And at the time when the news had gone out that she was selected, it was a huge deal, because it was like, I think,
First in the nation.
Exactly. So timeline wise, if you were to go back and do some research, I think it was like 2006. So that turned into a huge controversy. But she, I believe she would have been the first in the country, at least in California. But no, you're right. I don't know of too many. I know a lot of principals. Like I see more and more up and coming, especially even in our own district net right now and in the surrounding community. And again, part of it is it's sort of the age range, right? If you think about who's moving through the system, who's had enough time in their career to get to that place. And so we're going to see more and more because, of course, we hired more and more Vietnamese teachers as time has gone, passed. And
And they're more
many of them,
principal.
yeah, they're ready for that principal role. So we have many in our district that are either assistant principals, principals. And so we're seeing that number increase over time. And I'm really happy to see that. I'm just kind of, I don't know, I have a sense of like being proud when I see that another Vietnamese person has been selected into the administrative role, because again, it's around representation.
Yeah.
We here in Orange County have such a big, large number of Vietnamese families that we serve. And so there, but at the same time, it should be a balance. Like I'm really big on like that balance of like you said, do Hispanic students see their representation, right? Do Black students have representation for them? Like how, our diversity in leadership really should mirror if as close as possible.
Yeah.
But we know that the reality of that is very challenging.
Now, as an assistant superintendent that focuses on one thing, which is what you describe, do you need to sit in the other chairs or positions of, to have a wider spectrum of experience before moving on to becoming superintendent of this district?
Well, I think the more diverse background in terms of experience one has to then move into the next role is going to be so much more helpful. But no, I don't think you necessarily have to, let's say, be assistant superintendent of then personnel and then all of the other areas to then feel like you could be the superintendent of a district. Because at the end of the day, if you have really, really strong assistant superintendents and directors, really, the job of each of those folks is to advise and provide like bite-sized chunks of
Yeah.
information to the superintendent, right? Like you think about like the CEO isn't going to read every single report, right? They're not going to look at every single dashboard and data point. You're pulling out the most salient things that need to then be summarized because they're reporting directly to a board of trustees. And so, and a lot of times we know the board of trustees, those folks don't have an education background sometimes. And so now you're taking very complex education lingo, trying to condense down information into bite-sized, digestible chunks of information. And so, as a superintendent, you do need to have like a really good sense of everything that's happening in each of those departments, but you don't have to be an expert in it and you don't have to be in the weeds. If you hire good people, then you trust those people to do their portion, and then that helps kind
Yeah.
of balance out, what you need to know as a superintendent to do your job.
Do you have any inclination to move into another director or I'm sorry, into another assistant superintendent position? So are you gravitating in any other departments?
I am not. I'm actually, it's so funny because I wasn't sure how I would feel in my current role. I mean, I took it on as a challenge, but I will say I absolutely love my role. I wouldn't
No.
have predicted this. If you asked me like 5 years ago where I'd be, I would have not named this as, being assistant superintendent of business services as an area of interest at all. Like I said, I was in my happy place as a
Yeah.
principal, but I absolutely love, love, love what I'm currently doing right now. I have a fantastic team of directors. There are seven directors in our division, and they're all great people, and I work very closely with them. And so I'm really enjoying the work that I'm doing. And so I don't really have an interest in any other area at this time to kind of move around should opportunities come up. So I'm very comfortable with where I'm at. I shouldn't say comfortable, like I'm happy with where I'm at. There's still uncomfort because I'm new to the role, so I'm still feeling like I'm learning a lot. I'm having to do a lot of research, ask a lot of questions, which is what we all should be doing all the time, no
Yeah.
matter how long we've been in a position, So no, I'm not interested right now in it. But you never know. I always just say this is how I feel in this moment right now. But I also tend to be one that I like movement and change. Like I haven't stayed in any one position for longer than 3 years. I have either moved schools or moved positions within three and a half years. So I'm hope now. So when I got to this position, I said, I am going to retire from this role. And that's a long time. I still have a while before I retire. But that was kind of like, what I had said when I got to this role. I'm retiring from this position.
Yeah, but that's a long time to be working, right? I mean, I'm thinking because we're about the same age, and for you to stay in this position for another 20 years before you retire, it's a long time.
It's not 20
I
years. I'm much older than you think. I'm
know.
finishing my 24th year in education.
Yeah. But do you have a lot of community engagement because you're right in the heart of Little Saigon? Do you have a lot of people in, like parents, that come to you to see if you can affect change within the district?
Surprisingly, no.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, no. The parents that I have interacted with have all been amazing. And especially when you work in the Vietnamese community, I don't know if you've ever experienced this. It's the strangest phenomenon. I never experienced it until I became an administrator. But when our and I never can tell like if the parents are like my age or older. Like, I don't know about you. I have a hard time assessing age and when I'm supposed to call someone like G or go or back or like, so I struggle with that. It's just a thing that I don't know. And people don't know what to call me because they
Yeah.
can never gauge my age, right? But anyways, so it's just this interesting phenomenon where if they see me when they're dropping off their student or whatever's happening, like I get what I don't know how to describe it. It's like a little baby bow. Like they just stop wherever they're at and they kind of do like a quick little head nod to me. And it's gratitude and it's appreciation and I get it. But it's so odd because, like again, I'm very Americanized
Yeah.
growing up here.
Yeah.
And so I get the baby bow and there's this sense of like respect, as an educator. But they always come up and they're so kind when they talk to me. In fact, there's almost like I don't see what I do as just like representing the whole community, if you know what I mean. I'm a lot of times I just go to work and I'm like, okay, we got this to do today. We got an assembly, let's get ready. So I don't think about the greater big picture of what I'm doing. And so I was like, oh, I'm the principal of the school, no big deal. Like there's a principal at every school, right? But parents would come up to me quite a bit and tell me, I'm so proud of you. Like, we don't see enough Vietnamese leaders in the school system. So I just want you to know, like, I'm so proud of you for just being here and doing this work. And so those are the types of conversations that I typically have with our parents. It's not them feeling like we need to do this, or can you start doing this, or can you look into this? It's been more around just an expression of like, hey, you're one of us. Thank you for doing the work. We're so happy that you're here. We feel a sense of connection to the school when we can just come up and talk to you in Vietnamese. Like, that's what I was getting a lot of.
Where is the future of education going from your point of view? Because I feel, as I talk to more educators, I feel like in our generation, when we were growing up, the way we were educated was just much more, it just felt more strict, more stringent, right? It just felt much more dynamic in terms of the push to really learn a lot. And I'm learning that that's not the case today. It just feels a little bit more, I don't know, maybe in America, it just feels a little bit more relaxed and let the child go as they should naturally. Where do you think the future of this formal education is going?
Well, it's funny because when you think of like education and the push and pull,
Yeah.
it unfortunately is has always been like a political ball that gets bounced around, especially during like election years, right? So it's interesting because there's all this talk always around like if I became, the president or I was the governor, this is what I would do with education. And so they always talk about education as one of their talking points around, when it comes to like politics. So unfortunately, as much as we want to stay very stable in what we do and what we offer kids, we are at the whim
Right.
of political entities and personalities that push and pull constantly about what we should be teaching. So that's something that has always happened. It's this tug of war, and we're kind of in the middle. Like, we will teach what we're told to teach because it's passed through statute, ed code, and law, right? So that's a challenge. And so I kind of don't know where we're heading with that, because you can kind of see there's been so much conversation about certain things and parents' rights and so on. So I'm not sure with that. Now, as far as like students and the role of education, you know, it has changed. You know, when we went to school and we wanted to learn more about things, we would go and find an encyclopedia and borrow that big thick volume for whatever letter, or go to the library, or go check out, you know, the microfilm reader. Or, you know, now information is at a student's fingertips. You could just quickly ask Siri for something or Google it. And so, you know, there's this sort of thought in mind as a teacher, is when you ask a student like a question, is it Googleable, right? Because if it is, it's not, you're not really going to get them
Teach,
to
yeah.
think. So it has shifted how we are asking students to express their learning, to convey their learning, and the whole process of learning itself. And so I think that the other complex thing is AI,
Oh my
right?
God. That's a whole nother hour of this podcast if we get
Exactly.
into
That's
it,
a
yeah.
whole nother thing, but it affects education, because now when you say, go home and write an essay on this topic, like, okay, well, students, they're going to use ChatGPT, or they're going to use some form of AI that's going to just quickly whip something out. And it's not really their true, authentic, you know, writing. And so now it's sort of like, do you have to do on-demand cold writes in class only, paper, pencil, no typing, no nothing, to really get? So it kind of changes, right? Like, so
Wow.
with
Wow.
technology, we need to really think about how we ask students to convey what they have learned, or to express what they have learned, because there's so many tools that are helping mask these things, right? So as far as choice, I mean, I think we do need to be probably less traditional, in the sense of thinking about, there are certain, we'll just think college majors, right? Like, there are certain majors, it's like, great, you can learn about it, but what are you going to do with that, right? Unless you plan on going into some form of research or teach it yourself, what's the student going to be able to do with that? So we kind of almost need to also update our thinking, because I'd say in the last 10 years, there have been how many different types of careers that are brand new that
Right.
didn't exist a long time ago. And so even as teachers, and we're trying to do like these career days and whatnot, who are we inviting in? We're still inviting in the
Traditional.
chiropractor, right? The lawyer, we're still inviting in. So, I mean, where's the content creator? Where's the, you know, game program design? You know, that kind of thing. Like, so we need to be, I'd say, more open to the idea that the landscape has changed. The careers that we are getting students ready for is different from what we were getting ready for, right? The skill sets might look a little different. So we as a whole, a collective whole, really need to be forward thinking when it comes to what's next for our students.
Thank you for sharing all this stuff about your journey in education. Now we're going to make a quick detour and end with the urban homesteading stuff that that you brought up, because you have a pot you had a podcast on this stuff. But what all of this world of education and your life in education, and then I'm like, what does this urban homesteading stuff have to do with? Where did that come from? And tell me a bit about it.
Well, okay, so with the stressful jobs in education, and your partner girlfriend can attest to it, you kind of need to have an outlet of some sort, some form of like therapy, relaxation, something that, you know, you could just do that's fun and you look forward to, right? For me, it's this kind of hobby urban homesteading thing that I got into back in, gosh, at this point, 2008, 2009. It's been a long time. And it started off with just the idea of like gardening. Like, I just want to grow my own food. I would like to not have to rely on food that's been sprayed with pesticides and herbicides, you know, just like something very basic, right? And it kind of transformed into, gardening, and then it turned into like food preservation. Then it turned into, oh, now I need a compost to make sure our soil is healthy. So, then it turned into, oh, I want my own fresh backyard eggs. And we ended up getting chickens, and we don't have chickens anymore. We have quail instead. So we have fresh quail eggs here all the time. But this concept is just really like self-reliance and self-sufficiency. Not that you just couldn't go to the farmer's market or to the grocery store and get your own things, but at the end of the day, if you really think about like food that's brought to market, it's not the best quality, right? The varieties are limited. It's been sprayed with chemicals, and they're not picking the best tasting thing. What you see at the grocery store, they're picking things that travel well, that have a long shelf life, but it's not best tasting or most nutritious, right? So it's just kind of like my personal choice to opt out of that sort of commercial industrial system of like, what can we produce our own? But it's fun. It's something I do on the weekends. It's something that I can share with family and friends. And it's something that is just very, it's like a sense of satisfaction, right? So like, tomatoes. We grow a ton of tomatoes during the summer. And it's just the best when I can bring a whole bunch over to my mom. And she's like, all right, it's time to make bunrio, right? It's like now you've got bunrio with homegrown tomatoes that just taste amazing. And so it's just a sense of satisfaction, and just really having quality food that tastes like food. So I guess that's kind of where we kind of our journey just led to other things.
But this idea of like getting off the grid, it's kind of impossible in this day and age, is it, for us, as regular people with regular jobs to provide enough to be self-sufficient in our own nutritional maintenance? It's impossible, right? To I just want to hear it from you, somebody who's
Absolutely. And that's why I said it's a hobby. So the goal isn't to be off grid on our part as well. Ours is just like whatever we could provide for ourselves, great. It's one less thing that I have to buy at the market. It's one less thing that I'm deciding to opt out. So, I mean, we can produce so many vegetables, and then we have like fruit trees and whatnot too here. And like I said, like I have so many quail eggs that I'm giving them away oftentimes. And so sometimes I don't even have to buy chicken eggs. But again, it's quality stuff. Like I know what I'm feeding my quails, I know what I put in my soil. So it's not to be off the grid. It's just the concept of learning how to do a lot of things on my own and not being so reliant on the system, And it kind of played out really well during the pandemic, when the shelves and the stores were sold out. I'm not a I wouldn't, well, some people joke that they think I'm a prepper and that I have a bunker here, but I don't. I don't have a bunker. I wouldn't call myself a prepper. But prior to the pandemic, I had already been doing a lot of the things and learning these skills. And so it was like, oh, all I need is flour and yeast and I can bake bread. Like it was just stuff that, because I found it interesting. That's all. Like making beef jerky and, sealing that and saving it for whatever, So it's just a fun thing. That's all. But no, there's no attempt to get off the grid here.
You sound like do you know who the Ravenous Couple are?
No.
They're a husband and wife, Hong Fook and Kim, and they're one's a doctor, one's a dentist, but they have this Instagram account called the Ravenous Couple, and they do Vietnamese food, and they do everything. They they're it's like their hobby, just like you with this urban homesteading. And you remind me, a lot of the things that you're talking about, because they have a kiln, they fire up their own ceramics. They do so much that is related to sort of providing for their own family the taste and the culture of Vietnam, and they recreate that, and it's beautiful work that they do. So it's a Ravenous Couple. But I want to ask you about, if we were to, as a family, right, want to go off grid, how much energy? So, and I don't want to get in the mathematics of it all, but how realistic is something like that, to go completely off grid, with the basic, vegetables, I mean, eggs, some fish or whatever? Like, can we, is it in this day and age possible, if you're living in Westminster or Fountain Valley, on an eighth of an acre, to provide for our own selves? I don't know how big a lot is, but
Off the grid is definitely not in Westminster.
it's a silly question, but
No. So I think that it is somewhat doable, but you do have to invest energy into it, right? So it's funny because you bring this up and my anthropology brains went straight to like hunter-gatherer mode, right? So it's like, oh, I mean, we live near the ocean. You can go catch fish. My husband goes fishing and he'll bring home a halibut every now and then, right? So it's sort of like, is it doable? You have to actually put in a lot of time and energy into food production and food preparation. And so is it doable? Probably not as a hobby, but if it was something that one was seeking to try to do full time, it could be possible. I always say it's amazing how much food you can actually grow in a small amount of space, and you could produce technically your own meat and eggs. Like some people keep rabbits, some people will keep the quail, and then they use it for both eggs and meat. Like they're small animals, like small hu animal husbandry that in an urban setting you could easily do, and they don't make any noise. No one would even know any different, and you could provide for your family that way. So is it possible? Yes. Would it be time intensive? It technically is pretty intensive to, grow your own food, produce, harvest, do any sort of like food preservation, because you really can't eat everything that you harvest all at once. And then if you're trying to get through the whole year, you got to preserve some of it, right? Some of it's got to go in the freezer, some of it's got to dry, some of it you got to pickle or whatever. So, is it doable? Possible.
And then lastly, why quails over chicken?
I have a whole episode on my podcast on that. So we moved homes so that we could have chickens. Like we actually sold the home in Irvine and moved to where we're at now so that we could have a backyard that we could have chickens. They ended up, they're really loud. Like
Chickens are loud.
chickens, yeah, they're
Okay.
really loud. Like and it was just a little bit more intense than I thought it was going to be. And it's okay. Like we enjoyed having them when we did. And then we ended up rehoming our chickens. And so when I switched to quail, I discovered they're very quiet. You wouldn't even know that we have them in our backyard. They don't need a free range. They produce just as many eggs as chickens, except of course they're smaller. So for every one chicken, you're going to want to have like four quail. But it's perfect for the urban homestead. So like, again, we have, one, two, three. We have three, I call them quail condos. My husband builds everything for me. And so there's enough there to produce eggs like all summer. And like I said, I have too many sometimes. I have to give them away. So yeah, chickens are loud. They're loud, messy, and dirty. But
And quails are
people who
not.
love their chickens love their chickens. Just not for me.
Tani, thank you so much. We talked a lot about education and that homesteading stuff is so cool. And it provides sort of this contextual backdrop to this total person, right? You have this awareness of the ecosystem of a natural ecosystem, the cultural side of in anthropology, and now this extensive experience in education. And thank you so much for sharing all of that with me today.
Thanks for having me. It was very nice meeting you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.